Welcome to the Perp Web Podcast, hosted by Joe Bosch.
Hello, and welcome to Perf Web 87. I'm your host, Joe Bosch. I'm going to need to just ask somebody if, can somebody bring me my phone so I can share it and show them the app? And I apologize, everyone. I don't know. I've lost my phone. So, but welcome to the program. Today's topic is going to be, thank you, kind sir, it's going to be non-ischemic open mitral valve surgery, systemic hyperkalemia. And it's basically how to arrest the heart in a very relaxed, easy way to do this particular operation. Of course, we're speaking about MIX, which is what we're going to be talking about. So this is PerfWeb 87. I think it's 1.2 CEU. We're broadcasting, of course. And David, what's my, contact us at perfusioneducation.com to reach out to us. Perfect. And there's our telephone number. If anybody wants to call in and be live on the air, I have to laugh at that. We've had that phone number for a very long time. I think we've had 10 people call in. We'd love to have more. And then also, our scroll bar has all of our information on there, how to register for PerfWeb and Perfusion Education, subscribing to our YouTube channel, our PerfWeb. Like us on Facebook and make sure you share us on the Twitter. So the scroll bar that you see right here will stay up the entirety of the day. All right, so let's go on to my slides and we'll do this. Oh yeah, I want to do the app. Also, for those of you, thanks. For those of you who have not yet gotten the app, I know many of you have. Let me first, I saved it to the wrong place. I have to share it. So we're not, it's not sharing. Is it going to do it or what? Well, it's trying to share to a 55-inch Roku TV. So moving on from there. Oh, wait, I think it came up. I know that's Apple TV. So give me just one more second here, folks, if you can. And unable to connect. And we'll try again. Okay, I'm done. It's not working. So let's go to my slides. All right, and I need to put this in. There we go. How's that? Perfect? Excellent. Non-ischemic open mitral valve surgery with systemic hyperkalemia. So many people say that MIX, or minimally invasive cardiac surgery, transfers the pain from the patient to the surgeon. I have a little bit different take on that. It's similar. It transfers the pain from the patient to the surgeon, then to the perfusionist, because when there's having problems and there's issues, it always seems to be somehow our fault. Well, there are a multitude of advantages to MIX. The first and sort of most obvious one is you're not going to do a sternotomy, or you may do a hemisternotomy, I guess, or you may do a parasternotomy, but I'm speaking today more about mitral valve surgery. So you're going to avoid that sternotomy. If you don't do a sternotomy, you're going to automatically reduce your infection risk. You certainly aren't going to get a deep sternal wound infection if you haven't done a sternotomy. It's also going to, and I think it's obvious why, reduce your ventilation time, which of course is going to improve or speed up your recovery, and of course reduce your length of stay. And especially with females, but I think with males too, there is certainly improved cosmesis. And so there's your scar from a MIX mitral valve. This is, not sure what's going on, David. Oh, it's not. Oh, there, I have to swipe that way. This is your scar from a sternotomy, so you can certainly compare that. And you could see which one you would prefer to have, especially if you were a younger person, right? But more importantly, and something, you know, cosmesis is important. I don't dispute that. But also you want to take into consideration if you're going to be doing a mitral valve on a redo sternotomy, somebody who's had previous sternotomy and had either coronary bypass surgery or something else, you can have, as you see, the aorta stuck up against the wall of the sternum. You can also have what's illustrated here is your internal mammary crossing over the midline. So there's very high risk to reopening the redo chest for obvious reasons. Of course, they knew, you know, they use the oscillating saw instead of the standard sternal saw, and it takes a much longer period of time. And of course, you know, you again have that higher risk. But the operation itself, just in exposure time, takes a lot longer. Well, you haven't been in the right chest, so that usually is virgin-like and very easy to access. So that's, you know, I want you to remember that those slides about those patients with patent coronary bypasses. So here is the surgeon kind of marking his spot. This is Dr. Metoyer doing this, and he's marking the spot where he's going to make his incision. You see the patient is on the bed supine, and there's a bump under the right shoulder. Of course, you need to have a double lumen tube for this particular technique, where you have to have the right lung deflated for gaining access and that kind of thing. But you can see he's where he's marking that spot, right anterior mini thoracotomy incision. This is what it looks like after you get into it. And of course, from this angle, it just looks like a dark hole. But what I want to show you is that hole is right where his fingers were at the time in the previous picture. And as we illuminate that, and I want to go back to this, here's your CO2. Let me see if I can do the highlighter. Yeah, here's your, this is going to be for CO2. Here is your left atrial retractor, which is helping to pull up the left atrium after he does the atriotomy. He puts a little counterpunch hole here down inferiorly, and this is a pump sucker that's going up and sort of draped over the inferior portion of the left atrium that's been pulled open. But there's your view. That's his view of the mitral valve. And you can see, I mean, it's just a straight shot down to it. The sternum, of course, is over-rotated over here, and anything to do with coronary surgery is way out over here where it's not in your way at all. There's no adhesions, there's no issues. And there you can see him placing a cardiotomy sucker through the diseased mitral valve that he is planning on either repairing or replacing. I do think that in this particular case, it was a replacement. So what are some of the disadvantages of MIX? And I think that for mitral valve, and I think this is sort of where this whole thing, this whole concept of doing this sort of came into my mind. So your option one, which was done by Dr. Petrasek for many, many years and very successful, and he was very, very, very fast, but it was straightforward fibrillatory arrest. You cool the patient, cool the heart, you fib arrest it, you do your atriotomy, you do the valve, you de-air, you close it, you defibrillate, and you're done. We used to use these, of course, back in the old days, essentially a 60-cycle generator, and you place the two probes on the heart, and it fibrillates the heart, so it precipitates that, and it's useful. Now, of course, some people use the endo balloon. We're all very familiar with that, and you can see that endo balloon is coming up the femoral artery here, and it's going, and you see it right there, inflated. And at the end of it, you can give cardioplegia, and you can vent. And you also have a line coming into the right IJ, which is going into the coronary sinus, and another line going into the pulmonary artery in order to provide additional venting and forgiving retrograde. You have your Venus cannula here in the right atrium coming from the IVC. And all of this is going on in some places. And of course, it's mandatory that you have two radial arterial lines when you do this, because as you can see, this balloon that I'm highlighting, if it migrates backwards, it could actually occlude the innominate, in which case your right carotid is not going to get a whole lot of blood flow. But if you were measuring the pressure only on the left side, your left subclavian would be patent. So that can be a real problem. It can also migrate forward through the aortic valve, and that's also problematic. So these cases could be really complicated, and it was very expensive material, and sometimes we would spend hours trying to get that coronary sinus catheter in, and I hated it. And the arterial flow cannula, which was obstructed by the endo balloon, was down to about a 14 French, somewhere around there. And we would have very, very extraordinarily high drainage pressures. So I was never very fond of the particular technique. Now, you could use both femorals, I guess, which is what they're doing in this particular picture, but they had a femoral cannula that you put the endo balloon through, as I remember it. Now, you could also use the Chitwood clamp, the long articulating clamp, and get it across. So if I come back to this view, you just have to do a little bit more dissection, and you can go in there and clamp the aorta, and maybe even open your incision a little bit, clamp the aorta, and use a long cardioplegia needle called a pig sticker to go in there and get that. But man, I'll tell you what, you're deep in a hole, and if you lose control of it, you've got some big bleeding problems. So they do it well. The ones that do it well, but it's, I think it's risky, and it increases risk, increases costs, and I think there is a better way to do this. And I will point something else out. The use of the endo balloon is contraindicated in the same way that using the systemic hyperkalemia technique, which I'm going to talk to you about, is also contraindicated. So there's no difference in that. Cross clamp would be the only way to do it if you had AI, and a significant AI. Although Dr. Metoyer says he can tolerate up to 2+ AI, I don't advocate for much more than trace to 1+ at the worst, because it can be, if you can't see, it's really, really, really stressful as far as that's concerned. So you want to have a pretty much competent aortic valve. So this alternative approach, the benefits and limitations of it are, of course, the visualization is excellent. Well, that's the same for both of them. You get a significant reduction in surgical instrumentation that you need. So you really decrease the cost a lot. You never touch the aorta. There's no ischemic time nor need for cardioplegia, much less hemodilution, potentially less RBCs transfusions doing it this mixed way, shorter OR time and possibly shorter pump time. That's sometimes true, sometimes not true, but that's, I think, where the whole idea, you know, was part of the equation in doing this. In order to do it my way, it requires bicarb-based zero potassium fluids. We'll talk a little bit about what those fluids are. It requires a very strong understanding of CVVH, which is, we'll use it synonymously with zero balance ultrafiltration, ZBUF, but I prefer the term CVVH. I think it is more accurate. It requires a great deal of cooperation between anesthesia and perfusion. So if you don't have a good relationship with anesthesia, it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to do these cases. And I think there is a significant cost reduction. And I mentioned, aortic valve cannot have more than minimal insufficiency. So I would say one plus. Dr. Metoyer, maybe he's two minus. But that really depends on your surgeon and what you're comfortable with. As long as you have a good drop sucker that you can put in there with good flow, a vacuum relief valve on it so it does not ever get stuck, because you don't want that to happen, and you can keep the field clear, you can do it. So you just have to assess that yourself and what your comfort level is. I want to talk a little bit about cardioplegia. It varies by composition, delivery methods, temperature, and additives. However, all solutions contain potassium, somewhere between 15 to 35 milliequivalents per liter, and it's needed for the induction of the diastolic cardiac arrest. As early as the late 1800s, physiologists were starting to become aware of the ability of potassium to arrest the heart, to arrest cardiac contractility, beginning with individuals like Sidney Ringer, who observed that potassium chloride froze the heart in diastole, that relaxed state, the one we're looking for is diastolic arrest, and calcium stimulated the heart during systole. So we all understand about calcium loading after ischemic arrest with standard cardioplegia. We have to be very careful of that for obvious reasons. An extensive body of research has established that hyperkalemic solutions induce significant vasoconstriction when experimentally applied to coronary artery and aortic ring preparations. Now, I bring this up because it's very important. I'm advocating for the administration of between 240 up to 400 milliequivalents of potassium chloride into your circuit and drive the patient's potassium up to a level of between, let's say, 11 and 15. I've had it go higher and I've seen it a little bit lower, and it really depends. Your renal insufficiency patients, especially dialysis patients that I've done, you're really going to have that potassium much, much higher than that heart to arrest. It's really interesting. I've seen them beating at 9 and 10, which was pretty impressive. And I've done this on several renal dialysis patients. So cardioplegia all contains it. Now, we're concerned about this phenomenon. And I wanted to go back to this slide because I had those stars there. Somebody had mentioned to me just recently that the administration of potassium would cause hypotension. And I'm just telling you, I've been doing this for a while now as far as this technique, and I've given a lot of patients a lot of potassium. I have yet to see the pressure go down versus having the pressure go up, where I've seen significant hypertension when I've administered too much potassium at one time, and I've kind of learned from that experience. I also wanted to mention about the effect of potassium on vessels. When you administer it in veins, a lot of times the patient will complain of pain. So there are, and I don't want to get into all of the biochemistry associated with this, but there is that concern, and that concern existed with this technique. But my whole point of adding this cardioplegia is the Del Nido formula, which there's Plegisol, Del Nido, but all of them basically are essentially the same. Whether it be 4-to-1, put 80 milliequivalents in a liter of Plegisol, you're giving it at a 4-to-1 ratio. So the amount of potassium you're giving is essentially equal to what you're looking at here. And so you see the potassium is 13 mLs. It's 2 milliequivalents per ml. So there's 26 milliequivalents of potassium in a Del Nido bag, and then you are going to add to, depending on the technique you use, we're going to put 250 cc's or plus or minus of blood in it, make it 1200 cc's of volume, and then we're going to give it. And so you're giving that level of potassium, which is a relatively high level of concentrated potassium, directly into the coronary arteries. And if you look at it from the point of putting undiluted potassium chloride in onto that coronary, I think that you can have intimal damage, but it's diluted and it's mixed in with blood and it's going in over time, and there's a lot of other factors. The other thing too is, remember, when we give the Dalneto, and most of us of course are already going to know this, so forgive me, but if you give it antegrade, as you see in this picture here, and it goes into the coronary arteries, of course the coronary ostia are here and here, it eventually makes its way out the coronary sinus, which of course we know is in the right atrium, and here's your venous cannula going to the pump. So whatever cardioplegia you give, it just doesn't all stay right in the coronary circulation. It ends up coming right back to the pump. That entire volume of 1,200 cc's of Dalneto, the 1,050 volume of the crystalloid, all comes right back to the pump. So it's a transient phenomenon that occurs going through the coronaries and getting the myocyte potassium levels as high as you're doing. And so that's kind of how that works. You want to, it works just fine, but it may in fact cause some coronary, here, Magic, can you grab this? Or David, I'm sorry. Here, I'll just throw it. Thanks. Thanks, it's Tammy. She'll call back. It can cause some coronary spasm while you're giving it. I mean, that is a phenomenon that can occur. And because I see it happen systemically so frequently, I do think that that is something that can happen. However, and with that said, Dalneto cardioplegia has, of course, lidocaine in it, mannitol, and the other bicarbonates, buffered, seems to work very, very, very well. And clinically, so scientifically, there could be something. Clinically, we just don't really see it. And it works. So let's go from there. So what is the foundation of this technique? And I'll get into the technique here momentarily. But in 2006... a surgeon by the name of Gary Jones, I saw him and he said, look, I've got this 70-year-old female, had four-vessel CABG, has a patent lema to the LAD. The CT shows the lema is vulnerable to sternotomy and she's living on it, but no other coronaries can really be done for her, but she presents with severe mitral regurgitation. We discussed using the 60-cycle fibrillator I talked about a minute ago, but there were some real concerns over a protracted fibrillation time. And if you're cold and empty, you know, is that really going to be problematic? I'm not really sure, but we went through some of the literature. And this was written a long time ago, I recognize that, but I don't think physiology has changed that much. But the amount of energy used, even in cold, empty fibrillatory arrest, is higher than what the demand is, much higher than what the blood flow supply through the coronaries can be. So it is problematic. And in fact, if you look back through Patrasik's work, you do find that he had myocardial dysfunction was not an uncommon problem. And, you know, he was fast, so he was able to deal with it and still had excellent outcomes. But myocardial dysfunction postoperatively was not an uncommon finding, needing to be on maybe some milrinone or some other pressors. So keep that in mind. This was something that I thought said to me, even cold, and empty, fibrillatory arrest may not be the best way to go about this. And of course, there was not going to be a cross clamp, so I knew the heart was going to be fibrillating, it was going to be perfused. So I was like, well, why can't I just make the heart quiet? So I went back and I looked through all of the data, and instead of reading this whole thing to you, the bottom line is there are roughly 3,675 milliequivalents of potassium in the intracellular space, 3750 total body. Most of it, of course, we know is intracellular, very little extracellular. If I gave this patient enough potassium to raise their potassium level, and at the time I was thinking 12 or 13, it was going to be between 300 and 400 milliequivalents of potassium is what I figured I was going to need. Well, that's only 10% of the total patient's potassium load, actually less than, depending on how much you give, you only gave 300. So I was like, well, I don't think that can really hurt anything. I mean, what is the deleterious effect? What is the problem with severe hyperkalemia? And the problem with severe hyperkalemia is diastolic cardiac arrest. So I thought, well, that's a really good idea. Let's try it. What do you think? So Dr. Jones was very brave and he decided to do it. And this slide basically just shows you the distribution of fluid in the body. We won't go over it very much, but it's just as a reminder of where everything is. And it's relevant as we kind of move forward with this. Okay. So here is the original study, and I'll show it to you here. It was published in ISP, and there is the title. And I'm going to give myself a little pat on the back here, but and this has bore out to be correct, based on my best knowledge at the time and what has been, again, bore itself out. This was the first description of the use of induced hyperkalemic arrest in the perfused heart to achieve cardioplegia for minimally invasive mitral valve surgery. And what we did for this particular case was a little different than what I have since evolved into. So you have the blood coming from the oxygenator here. Oops, I have to fix that. Let's see. There. Try that. Yeah, that may be a little better. You have the blood coming from the oxygenator here. So through a little vent line, a little shunt line, going into a pump, through a hemoconcentrator, and back to the oxygenator. And I used a cardiotomy reservoir here filled with a zero potassium bicarb-based fluid. And what I did was pumped out of it through a peristaltic pump into the hemoconcentrator, counter current to the blood flow. So the blood flow is going this way, and we're going with this way. So counter current. And then back to the cardiotomy reservoir. And I did this for a period of time. I had about 3 liters in there, 15 minutes, and then I would dump that and put another one up. And of course, that gets us into the whole conversation of diffusion versus convection. The only thing I was really interested in removing was potassium. And actually, this technique worked very, very, very well. The potassium diffuses very readily across that as long as you have good flow. What you have to be able to do is either measure the potassium in the dialysate solution so you're not, doesn't let it become equilibrated. And of course, the higher the potassium in the blood, the more often you have to change this. But I figured out that there was a better way to do this, and we'll discuss that now. So that was my first attempt at doing this, and it's what I published, but this later technique you'll see, I think, works much, much, much better. So this is a circuit, and make sure that you can see the marker. Here's the venous blood coming from the patient. It's entering the venous reservoir here, goes into the, we use centrifugal pumps, goes into the membrane oxygenator, out of the oxygenator, back to the patient's arterial system. Now we have a recirc line coming out of our arterial line that we run through hemoconcentrator number one. We then have, as you see here, a line going through a roller pump to hemoconcentrator two, which comes up and goes back into the venous reservoir. This hemoconcentrator is for removing the potassium. This hemoconcentrator I use for volume control. Now, you can do this any way you want. You could probably do it with just one, but I'll tell you what I do, and then you can decide for yourselves. Then I have the Duasol solution. I'll talk about those formulas here in a minute. Up here with a double spike, it goes through a roller pump and then re-enters the hemoconcentrator line going back to the venous reservoir post hemofiltration. So this is your waste. So this is the blood coming in, hemoconcentrated blood coming out, replenishing the plasma water with what I want the plasma water to look like going back into the venous reservoir. And you can see here on the Duasol, they come with a variety of different formulas. You have 0K, 3 calcium, that's the one that we use. But if you're using this for other reasons, you can also have potassium of 2, potassium of 4, and you can read it across the line. So these are bicarb-based solutions. And the reason why I prefer these is that if you use 0.9 sodium chloride, you're going to become hypernatremic because of the amount of volume you do with this. It's 20 to 25 liters worth of this fluid. And if you do that with normal saline, that can become quite challenging. So you have to switch every once in a while to half normal, and then you're putting bicarb in it, which makes the sodium go up even more. Then you have to add calcium and you have to add magnesium and all of these things. It's just really easier to buy bags of this stuff that come two 5-liter bags per box, and it's very easy to use. You can look it up. It's called Duasol. There's Prismasol. There's the next stage fluid. I can't even remember the name of what it is. They have all these fancy, cute names, but basically bicarb-based CVVH fluid. You Google that, you'll be able to find it. So what is my process to arrest the heart? So I draw up 200 milliequivalents of potassium chloride in syringes, and I make sure they are labeled. You do not want to not label, we know that. Have an additional 200 in the bottles because you don't know how much you're going to need. You initiate bypass, of course it's fem-fem, as you know, as you can imagine. Assure you have good drainage. And before you even do this, you've looked at the echo and everyone's happy with the aortic valve competency, okay? Start your Esmolol bolus and drip, and we do this. It really reduces the amount of potassium you have to give. It slows the heart rate down quite nicely. Start cooling with a water temperature set to 18 degrees. So you really want to quick cool this patient and get that heart going frozen. At the same time, you start adding potassium. Now, I put on here 50 milliequivalent aliquots, but I would give 20. Wait a second and see what that blood pressure does. Give another 20. Wait and see what that blood pressure does. If you slam in 50 your first shot, or you slam in 100 on your first shot, I've seen the blood pressure go from 40 to 140 very, very quickly. So you really do need to respect the amount of hypertension you can see with potassium infusion. And that's different. And I'll tell you, somebody that told me they saw it be hypotensive, I don't think it was the potassium. I think that's something that has become somewhat of a myth. If you give cardioplegia on a clamped aorta in the root and dilate the root and you increase the pressure in there with the baroreceptors, then you get a vasodilatory effect. I think the reason, and maybe even the cold, that could be doing it too. But I think it's the baroreceptors that are causing it, not the chemoreceptors, because if it was the potassium, I've seen potassium cause hypertension. Now, that may not be the case in the root. I'm not 100% sure in the chemoreceptors there, but certainly in the baroreceptors, it's seeing a much higher pressure, and that reflex of vasodilatation seems to make logical sense to me. Because I know if I give that potassium into the pump and I give it too fast, that blood pressure goes up every single time. I've never seen it go down. I just wanted to point that out. Pearls for the arrest phase. The more volume in your reservoir, the more potassium you're going to need. Don't have a volume of 2,500 or 3 liters and start giving your potassium, because if you do, you're gonna require much more potassium than you would if that volume was much lower. And that just has to do with volume distribution. I mean, you know, it makes sense. So go on pump. If you see you have a lot of volume, start hemoconcentrating early and try to get your level down to about 600 or 800 cc's. It will make this procedure much more pleasant for everyone. Do not give the KCL too rapidly. We've belabored that point. Keep cooling the blood until flatlined. And it happens pretty fast. So it's not like you're not gonna make the patient 18 degrees. I can assure you of that. You probably won't even get under 32 if the patient came in at 35. Do not use insulin to control the glucoses. The replacement fluid has sugar in it at 104. I'm not sure exactly what the number is. Maybe it's 100. But as you are removing it, it'll remove the potassium. So anything that's higher than the dialysate fluid is going to diffuse out. Anything that is lower is going to get added in too. But if you're doing the valve and your sugar comes back 260, which, you know, you don't want it to be, but if it does, and you give insulin, well, guess what's going to happen? Your potassium is going to come down. The heart might start beating, and then you're going to start giving some more potassium, and that potassium that went intracellular is going to eventually come back out extracellular at some point in time, probably later, for a rebound. So think about what you're doing while you're doing it. To leave it at 260 for a brief period of time through the valve when you're going to correct it using the CVVH will be the way to do it, the better way to do it. Do not overreact if you see some activity. Sometimes you'll see some electrical, you know, the waveforms, it's not well organized. And maybe you look over there and you even see the heart maybe move just a teeny little bit. That's not going to consume much in the way of oxygen, and it's really not going to interfere with the surgeon's ability to operate, putting in the stitches in the annulus, or if he uses core knots, seating the valve and then tightening them up. So don't overreact. Use the least amount of potassium that you need to get the heart to be as quiet as you possibly can, but don't make the enemy of this is really good be perfect, because sometimes you do get complete electrical quiescence and sometimes you don't. It's not exact, but it's not coarse fibrillation where you're chewing up all of those ATP stores, which is where you really get yourself into trouble. Don't bother measuring the potassium unless you have a device that reads it to 18. If you send it to the lab, they're going to freak out and they're going to be calling, and they're even if you talk to them up front and tell them you're going to have to dilute it, they can't. By the time they get the first one done and the entire world has been set on fire, you're pretty much done with the case. So most people use POC. If you have the Siemens Rapid Point, and I think even the GEM now too, you can actually measure potassiums up to 18. The iStat and the Epoch do not. They only go up to 9, so you'll just see greater than 9. So I wouldn't even bother, because it's greater than 9. The only time you really want to know is the potassium coming down. So where you started, you aren't going to know. That's why I usually look at the heart. If it's just maybe a little bit of doing a little nothing, you know, a little like swooning, I leave it alone. A little bit of activity, I leave it alone. If it's disorganized, it's not coarse fibrillation, and it's just not bothering anybody, I leave it alone. Process for removal. Discontinue the esmolol drip. Rewarm in your usual fashion. Run hemoconcentrators at full. Use replacement fluid flow to maintain your level, and run replacement at about 700 to a liter per minute. So I'm gonna go back to this picture and just tell you, when I'm removing the potassium, I have this blood roller pump, this one right here that I'm circling right here. I have this one running for this hemoconcentrator at about a liter a minute. So I can write that. 1 liter per minute. And then I have this roller pump with this fluid running at a rate, and this is just free flowing into a Neptune. I mean, it comes out really, really fast. I run this roller pump with the replacement fluid going back into my venous reservoir for my level at whatever rate I have to keep my level the same. If my level starts to go down, I increase this roller pump. If my level starts to go up, I increase the amount of hemoconcentration from hemoconcentrator one. So that's how I do it. And it seems to work. It seems to work well for me. Removal, the more volume in the reservoir, the slower you will remove the potassium. Same phenomenon in the opposite direction. Use insulin at this point sparingly if needed. You really shouldn't need it. Depend on the Duasol. And I want to go back to that, actually, to the Duasol bag. Where did I have that? Do you remember? Oh, there it is. And you can see here the glucose level. And it'll keep your glucose right at 100. So it's perfect. Okay. Loop diuretics can be helpful, but then you have the problem of, you know, what are you going to do when they're still peeing later and you're off pump and you can't fluid resuscitate easily. So I'm not a big fan of using loop diuretics, but if you aren't able to get the potassium down, you gave more than you thought, you needed some help, it does work for obvious reasons. Expect 15 to 20 liters. I would say have five bags, have five liter bags, 25 liters. I would have more than that. Be careful with rebound post-pump hyperkalemia. It can happen. But we have never had a patient code as a result of it. We've come out of the operating room with the potassium of 4.2 and it was 5.5. And, you know, it caused some excitement. I've even seen it go up to six, but never any higher than that. So just make sure you get it all out, right? And one of the most important things, pacer wires. If you do this minimally invasive technique, I'm going to come over here, show you this picture. Yeah, that's a good picture right there. In this particular picture, the heart is decompressed, and you really can't see it because it's not light, but it's down here. The pacer wires can be sewn on by the surgeon. When you're filling the heart up and you get it nice and full and it's beating and all of that, it's all the way over here. You can't even see the wall that you want to put the pacers on anymore. And you're off pump and everyone forgot the pacer wires. Put the pacer wires on before you consider trying to wean off pump. And I make myself a little note. I have it written right there, pacer wires. It just says it. We've done it once, and I've only done it once, and I'm never going to do it a second time. So don't forget the pacer wires. Okay, and more pearls for room pacer wires. There you go. Okay, so now I want to go over this. Isoosmotic ultrafiltration. Why did I say all that I said about having your level lower versus higher when you're giving the potassium or removing the potassium, whatever the case may be? So here is our blood. Our blood is here. And I'm going to give our blood. Can you read that or do I need to use a different color? You can't? Okay. Let me pick a different color. Because I'm running early anyway. Yeah. Well, it doesn't really give you that option. Because that's a marker. It doesn't give you that as a pen option. But let me try it. I'm going to give this a potassium of 5.0. Okay? I'm going to hemoconcentrate. Here's our hemoconcentrator. And I'm going to remove the plasma water. So here is our blood level right now is here. And I'm going to remove this much. So I'm going to go here. So I moved that much, and now my level is here. Well, I started out with 5. Now this concentrated blood down below, so all of this is gone now. fluid. Here's your new level right here. The potassium is still 5, and the potassium in this waste container is still 5. It is 5. It just is 5. Not is, still is 5, is 5. If I remove even more fluid, and I bring this level down to there, so everything that I'm coloring in now is gone. This potassium with this little bit of fluid is still 5. And this, of course, gets filled up. I'm filling it up. Everything is full over here. And the potassium is still 5.0. Everything stays the same because you are not selectively removing ions. You are only removing fluid. So let me go try that. I'm going to try to do that one more time with a different pen. I'm going to do this. I want a different color. So I'm going to pick this color. So this is full currently. I'm going to fill it up with blood. Okay, completely full. And the potassium inside there is 5.0. Okay, 5.0. This is empty right now, has nothing in it. But I'm going to go fill it up through the hemoconcentrator. I'm going to fill it all the way nearly to the top. Which means that this is only this much volume. And in this circumstance, this potassium of this blood is still 5, and the potassium of everything in here, all this fluid, is also 5.0. Now, if I take a fluid from here with 0 potassium and I put it this way and I fill this tank, with this and it mixes with the blood, and now I have rediluted this hemoconcentrated blood, and it was 50%, so I put half of it in there. This potassium is now going to be 2.5. I think that made sense. It made sense to me because I understand it. I'm not 100% sure it made sense to everyone else the way I explained it. But if you anybody has any questions, you know how to reach out to us. Contact at perfusioneducation.com. And we have a question, and you are more than welcome to send me an email or call me, and I will go over this. But this technique is so beautiful, and it works so well. Hello, Joe. What is the timing for initiation of the CVDH X-clamp period? What time frame is expected before normal K levels are achieved? Great question. So cross-clamp period doesn't exist because you're not going to use the cross-clamp. You start, what I normally do is, if they're using Cornot and I start to cheat, okay, as soon as I know that I see them parachute the valve down and they're comfortable, I know they're going to start using the Cornot to start cutting them. I start removing the potassium at that point in time. They generally don't want me to until they have closed the atrium, but I know if I wait, you know, depending on the speed of your surgeon, if I wait, I'm going to be there all afternoon and I'm going to miss my tea time, and I don't like that. So I cheat. I start a little bit. If I start seeing some activity or whatever, a little more activity, I just wait. I just stop at that point in time and just kind of wait. But I want to get it moving in that direction, and some equilibration will take place. Let me see the second part of the question. I forgot it already. I got a terrible memory. I'm going to need to get some Prevagen. And then what time frame is expected before normal K levels are achieved? That's another great question. It depends on how much potassium you had to give, what the level of your reservoir is, the lower the better, how fast you're running through removing the ultrafiltrate that you're replacing. So how fast can you replace what you're removing? So they're both obviously related to each other. So your ultrafiltration rate is going to, that's why I like to pump through it to cause a positive pressure and really pour that ultrafiltrate out as I'm returning the zero potassium fluid distal to the hemoconcentrator and do it that way. I like to see flows in the, usually about 700, 500 to 700 cc's per minute. And it usually takes about 15 to 20 liters. Sometimes you can do it. You might need a little more, sometimes maybe a little less. But again, it really depends. That's when I start measuring the potassium. So I'll run that for about 20 minutes. And now you see why I have to cheat, because if I had to wait until they just closed the left the atriotomy, there's no way I could be done fast enough. It's going to take me probably 45 minutes to 30 minutes to an hour, depending on how much flow, how much volume, how much potassium. But I would say, for the sake of being safe, figure an hour. And once it's down, again, you may see some rebound later, but as long as you, the lower it goes, the higher it is, the faster it's removed, obviously. The lower the potassium gets, the more volume you need to remove it, because your gradient has changed. And so that's going to be, that just is the way it is. But I would say an hour would be good. But 45 minutes, I've done it as early as 30 minutes. It just depends on flow. And I'm talking about through the hemoconcentrator, amount of ultrafiltrate, amount of fluid you're removing, how much potassium you had to give, and how much volume, total volume of blood you're dealing with. Because if your potassium is 10 milliequivalents per liter, and you have 7 liters versus you have 4 liters, you easily could see the total amount of potassium that you have to remove would be less by that amount. So that's why I do that. Any other questions? You have a comment? Great presentation. Thank you. Who's that? Mark. Mark Vallelonga. Vallelonga. Hey, Mark. I'll just call you Mark. I can't pronounce your last name. Mark, hey, thanks. I appreciate it. Let me know if you ever want to try this technique. I'll come up and help totally for free. I just really love it. And just for people to know, I've been doing this now since 2006. And I personally, I've done probably 50, 60 maybe of these cases since then. But I've converted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 cardiac surgeons to this being their preferred technique. So we've done it in various places around the country, and it's really a pleasant case. It's enjoyable, and it really, is fun to do, especially when you see how it works. You're like, man, I never thought I would do that. So I've really enjoyed it. So anybody has an interest in using this technique or wants to know more about it, please don't hesitate to reach out to me. I'm always happy to talk about it. Thank you. Okay, any other comments or questions? No other comments or questions? Okay, so I'm only 5 minutes early. I hope y'all won't mind. And don't forget, tomorrow is our inaugural adult ECMO specialist course, which for those of you who may be watching on PerfWeb, that's going to be available for unlimited members in June for the didactic portion. But we have an adult ECMO specialist course, which has the full courses, the didactic portion, and then the simulation portion is here in Houston at Memorial Hermann, the Woodlands Hospital here in the Woodlands, Texas, just north of Houston proper. You can check us out on mediweb.us. You can take my slides down if you want and put something else up. Maybe Mediweb or something. I don't know. Can you do that? Not sure. You can't put the ECMO course up, can you?
No.
No? Okay, well, yeah, so, well, you know what I can do? Here, look. I can do this. Watch this. Mediweb.us. Go. All right. There you go. Throw that up. And then you see here, here's MediWeb.us, and you see here Adult ECMO Specialist Course. You'll click that to get more information. And boom, there's all your information right there. And I would definitely, if I were you, I would definitely check it out. It's going to be a fantastic program. Okay, excellent. Thank you. Anything else? Okay, we have to apologize because our phone line, when you, the phone system is not working correctly. You know, and they'll have it fixed for next show. And I just want to make y'all laugh because I said something about it this morning and they said, no one ever calls, Joe. And then here, two people tried to call and it didn't work. So I apologize for that. We'll get it fixed for next time. Thank you all very much. And, you can always reach me. Like I said, contact at perfusioneducation.com. Leave me your number. I'll call you back. And if you had a question or you want to discuss something, please don't hesitate to do that. Thank you all very much, and I will see you next show. Bye.